You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century.
I remember that morning, it was actually a very beautiful day. And the days before, we had also been wheat pasting posters around Concordia to call people to come to the protest.
September 2002 began a school year dominated by questions of academic freedom, the role of the Concordia Student Union, CSU, in student activism, and the Israel-Palestine debate.
A lot of us who were involved in different movements in the city had joined to support what was at the time pretty modest but meaningful Palestine solidarity protests that were taking place. And that included the same networks that came together in September 2002 to protest the presence of Benjamin Netanyahu, who at the time was a former prime minister of the Israeli state, who was scheduled to speak at Concordia University.
Hundreds of students gathered around the hall building on the first day of school, attempting to attend or to disrupt a scheduled speech by then-former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Netanyahu was invited by the Jewish student group Hillel. Hillel is a Zionist institution with 850 chapters on campuses across the world, in particular in North America. Their official vision is to see that every student is inspired to make a commitment to Jewish life, learning, and Israel.
At this point in Netanyahu's career, he had previously served in the IDF, or Israeli Defense Force, as a unit leader in the Sayeret Matkal, a then-secret reconnaissance force, and had also founded the Jonathan Netanyahu Anti-Terror Institute in the United States, which worked to sow an image of terrorism as the largest threat to, quote, Western values and democracy, which Netanyahu claimed to warrant abandoning commitments to international law and multilateral UN-led action, and instead using whatever means necessary to annihilate the threat of terrorism.
This concept of terrorism served to equate the evil of terrorist activity with Arabs and Muslims in general, and Palestinians in particular, to justify Israeli occupation and expansion into Palestine.
The subject of Netanyahu's speech, had he not been prevented from speaking, was Bush's war on terror. And we think at least parts of the speech were published online because we found them quoted, but haven't found the full speech.
In the 1970s, terrorism had become a moral framework used by U.S. officials to condemn and delegitimize enemies of the state, according to Palestinian-American academic and political theorist Edward Said. Israel had learned how to co-opt U.S. policy, cynically exploit Jewish fears of another Holocaust, and stir up latent Judeo-Christian sentiments against Islam to turn the U.S. political machine into another weapon in the battle against Palestinian self-determination.
So just a couple of days before the first anniversary of September 11th, this protest, which many have described as a riot at Concordia, shows some of the aftermath of the rise of Islamophobia and anti-Arab sentiment. And Netanyahu's position was clear that he called on global powers to wake up to what he saw as a rising Arab threat.
This was the year after 9/11, September 11th, and the domestic front of the U.S.-driven quote-unquote war on terror was taking place. So this had very deep consequences for a lot of vulnerable communities, not only in Montreal, but across North America or Turtle Island. And so there was a lot of organizing taking place. My name is Stefan Christoph. I'm an artist and community organizer. In September 2002, I was really involved in grassroots activist movements in Montreal. I was particularly focused on migrant justice organizing at this time. I was coming at that organizing, having been first involved in the global justice movement before 9/11. And there was a huge effort to try to connect local and global critiques of capitalism, of US-driven imperialism and war. And so there was this constant discussion in these activist networks at the time between the global and the local. And so in that year also, what had happened was there was an uprising in Palestine, so in the West Bank, and also in Palestinian communities across the world, people were protesting for freedom in Palestine and also to oppose the ongoing Israeli state colonization in Palestine.
My name is Sabine Friesinger. I used to be the student union president in the early 2000s, in 2002-2003 was my mandate. But before that, I was also very involved, always at various levels in the student union. And currently, I run a print shop with my partner, and I also work at a community housing center. And I'm also union president of my local union affiliated with the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Yeah.
Can you situate yourself in the date of September 9th?
Yeah, so I see September 9th with the failed visit of Bibi Netanyahu as, like, there was a lead-up to that, of course, and that lead-up was because there was very strong Palestine organizing on campus, and people, SPHR always kept it in the conversation, and that became, I think, for the Zionists a little bit, but especially also for the public relations part of the university, maybe a little scary, because in the universities were, you know, starving for funding and so on, so I think that they were worried about their image at Concordia. And so then came along the Asper Foundation that basically paid for the visit of Netanyahu to come to Concordia. They proposed, like, we give you this donation, condition is to bring Netanyahu. Netanyahu at the time was in re-election process for prime minister. He wasn't prime minister at the time, but he was trying to run again. And so basically, this talk at H110, in hindsight, we see it was an election talk he was supposed to be giving, where he would talk to his supporters. And so this, for us, was completely against the principles of a university. So, for example, in a university, most other talks, it's open to anyone to come in and attend the talk, right? And people can ask their questions. There's an exchange of ideas and debate and dialogue. Whereas with the Netanyahu failed visit, I like to say it's failed visit because it was. It was a whole process of screening at the entrance, and it was tested by some activists and folks who tried to attend and go into the event, and a university screened them. They were refused attendance to the talk. So, you know, SPHR, when they found out that he's coming, there was, like, a whole, like, organizing around that. We have to do something. We have to call for a protest. Mm-hmm. We have to call. Because, first of all, they came to the union to say, you should tell the university to stop this and not have him attend it, you know, in the university. But the university, of course, they were, like, determined to have him speak. So students, basically what they did is they issued a citizen's arrest warrant against Netanyahu, put up posters, and we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have Instagram, we didn't have Twitter to organize from. We would organize from posters. And the day of, nobody really knew, like, how much, you know, again, no Facebook, no social media to be able to gauge, are people going to show up or not. So it was massive. There was a massive protest outside of the hall building. People just decided to block the entrances so that he couldn't attend. And I was, like, in the student union, and I was just, like, more, like, supporting the organizers of the event. But it turned out into a big mess. People call it a riot. It was more of an uprising, I think. It was more of the culmination of students and, you know, regular citizens even that joined the demonstration that were just fed up with the way the university was cracking down, on the one hand, on Palestine organizing, and yet displaying the red carpet for, at the time, he was a war criminal. Now we can see he's a psychopath, you know, he's a total psychopath. And I just wonder how many lives would we have saved if the university, the city of Montreal, had actually taken steps to arrest him, for example, or to stop him.
In the days preceding Netanyahu's arrival, this warrant for arrest appeared on Concordia campus and in downtown Montreal. It had been released by activists who were outraged that a war criminal was being invited to speak at a university campus.
This warrant, dated September 9th, 2002, permits the immediate arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu, former Prime Minister of Israel, on the charges of crimes against humanity and crimes of war. According to verified sources, Mr. Netanyahu will be in Montreal on September 9, 2002, and will be in the vicinity of the Hall building at Concordia University between 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Mr. Netanyahu is to be arrested on site by either competent authorities or ordinary citizens and residents. Canada's own war crimes legislation authorizes the arrest and trial of war criminals for offenses committed outside the country. As Prime Minister of Israel between 1996 and 1999, and as an official of the Israeli government, Mr. Netanyahu is alleged to have committed, or to have been directly complicit in, gross abuses of human rights in the Palestinian occupied territories and the State of Israel. This warrant is issued in the genuine interest of ending the crimes of occupation in the Palestinian territories and the State of Israel, in a spirit of solidarity with the courageous resistance and the intifada of the Palestinian people.
I also distinctly remember, and I don't think that this was super widely reported, there was also a process of vetting for who would be inside the Hall building H110 for Netanyahu's event. So that was another point of protest where we were saying, well, this is also not really a public event. This is like a private rally for the State of Israel and particularly for the right-wing faction Netanyahu, who had essentially killed any sort of hopes of whatever, if you wanted to believe in that or not, the Oslo process, and led to a whole process that saw the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Anyways, back to Concordia, people were wanting to protest his presence and they couldn't even get into the event, A. B, they had sealed off H110 and they were basically had given this pro-Israeli government student group, Hallel, the right to sort of occupy the space. And so there was all these layers of this event that set it up to sort of create the conditions for it to not work out. And it also led to a lot of people coming to the protest, just on the basic argument that Netanyahu was going to occupy the main auditorium at Concordia and spew this totally racist perspective on Palestine. And so there was a whole network of activists. I would say it was largely younger activists, largely people from, let's say, the Palestinian student community, and a lot of anarchist organizers, people, you know, who are connected with, as I mentioned, migrant justice or prison justice activism, indigenous solidarity work. So there was an understanding of what we were doing as connected to these efforts to sort of think critically about colonialism as it was represented at the time. For us, protesting Netanyahu was important to stand in solidarity with Palestine and also Palestinian voices in Montreal who wanted to call out the fact that Concordia was welcoming Netanyahu, but also to think of his presence as connected to, you know, a global network of colonial power. And this was very much articulated at the time. And I remember in the meetings leading up to this protest on September 9th, 2002, we talked about how, you know, Netanyahu and the Israeli colonial project was inherently connected to thinking critically about Canada's colonial history and about the borderlines between the U.S. and Canada, and how those borderlines are so inherently connected to the Canadian state and the U.S. state's support for Israel. So we were talking about all these things at that time. The year previous to that protest, I'd been one of the coordinators of the public education event series that had been taking place at the Concordia Student Union. So I was organizing events that looked at all these issues at that time. So a lot of networks were forming around these events and different campaigns and protests. We were thinking about how a lot of communities were affected by war at that time and displacement, and then how people were facing the consequences of a crackdown of domestic policies that impacted migrants and refugees at the time. That, of course, extended to implications for the Palestinian community, but many others. So I can say quite clearly, my relationship to the Palestinian community in Montreal was developed really in the context of also doing local work and supporting Palestinian students, but also community members, workers, who are having a lot of issues around their immigration status as a result of the tightening of border policies that was taking place at that time in the context of the quote-unquote war on terror.
Do you want to walk us through some of the maybe tactics or strategies in organizing?
Well, from the onset, it was quite clear that there was going to be a public protest to oppose the presence of Benjamin Netanyahu at Concordia. But also there was a lot of autonomous initiatives, direct action initiatives, and spaces where people were thinking about the fact that the public protest was needed, and we needed to also make sure that a large number of people were able to join a protest in solidarity with Palestine, but also to oppose Netanyahu's presence, and also feel safe at that protest because of a lot of the issues that I raised, you know, precarious immigration status, international students. We, of course, didn't know how this was going to play out, but we were having these conversations at the time. So we wanted to make sure that there was an opportunity for large numbers of people to join a public demonstration if they wanted to be there. And so that was planned. And then there was a lot of different initiatives and autonomous organizing that was taking place. And I particularly would highlight, even at that time in 2002, I remember specifically anti-Zionist Jewish activists who were connected to anarchist organizing in the city, who were deeply involved also in those spaces, those activist meetings where we were talking and strategizing. I would say there was parallel processes going on. There was a lot of different efforts to try to bring people together to oppose Netanyahu's presence. And then there was more like public-facing opposition and criticism towards Concordia University for hosting this event, right? A lot of more, let's say, mainstream Arab and Muslim community groups were calling on Concordia to reconsider this invitation to Netanyahu. That was being expressed in different ways, but I would just mention that there was many different efforts taking place. And I think it's important to acknowledge that there was many different layers to a moment like this. And I think that often moments like this, when we look back, they sort of get flattened. We just see a few images, and we sort of think about the fact that Netanyahu wasn't welcomed at Concordia, which I think is a good thing.
A welcome meal is a welcome meal. Yes. Now, just because this welcome meal happens to kill Palestinian people, that doesn't mean he's not a war criminal. That doesn't make him controversial. That doesn't make him interesting. That he remains a war criminal.
The goal was quite simple, to be honest with you. It wasn't super dramatically planned. It was to go to the doors of H110 and protest Netanyahu's presence. And of course, we were aware that that could result in some sort of response from Concordia security. And I distinctly remember at the beginning of the day, there was police down in the front of the hall building, but up on the mezzanine, it was mostly Concordia security at the beginning. And people were very clear in expressing that they simply wanted to go as students and some community members, but most of the people I can remember their faces inside the building were young undergraduate students who were opposed to Netanyahu being on their campus, right? And so they were trying to go to the room that had been totally sealed off. There was all these different forces, and mostly grassroots forces, that went into this moment of protest. Many hundreds of people showed up. Probably at least 2,000 came at the beginning of the morning. It was beautiful, and people were chanting all around the hall building. And smaller groups were planning direct actions to try to be in the university, mostly students, to try to disrupt the proceedings that were going to be happening inside the university. And it was quite organized. And I also don't think that the security at Concordia was aware of how organized people were to be in the university, because they were trying to have the event happen while classes were still going on. So that left a lot of open doors. And just to underline that there was a public protest called for outside the building for people to join. The large majority of the people inside the building preparing to protest if Netanyahu came to Concordia were students, and I remember that. And there was others, I mean, I was in my early 20s, and I'd worked at the Concordia Student Union as an event programmer, and I'd worked on also content for the Concordia Student Union agenda, so I was around the student organizing space. And I just remember that a group of people were inside of what is now the Hive Cafe. And there was another group of people inside the building. And at a certain moment, it was decided to sort of go towards H110 once it was clear that they were still going to go forward with the event.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
Ben Edelman and Samir Mala created the NFB documentary,
also titled Discordia, which follows CSU VP Aaron Mate, SPHR VP of Comms Samer Elatrash, and Hillel President Noah Sarna through the events and aftermath of the September 9th protest that ultimately prevented Netanyahu from speaking that day.
In all of this like reporting on the aftermath of the events, again, we see this constant framing of the pro-Palestinian, anti-Netanyahu, anti-Zionist protesters as violent. And I would recommend watching the NFB documentary Discordia, because you see firsthand in the footage, there's a lot of fixation on the fact that a window on the Hall building was broken. Yes, the window was broken. What's really important to note is that we see the police begin brutalizing protesters before the window is ever broken. And the window is broken from protesters outside trying to get in to help the protesters inside, or perhaps even just banging too hard. It's a little hard to tell if they break it intentionally. Maybe they did.
Even if it was intentional property damage, I mean, for me, that doesn't disqualify it in any way, shape, or form as something that's legitimate here. Mm-hmm. But I think your point as to this kind of fixation with the broken window is something that we see obviously a lot in media coverage. You know, the reason it turns from a protest to the language of a riot is because of something like this.
Yeah, property damage. Property mm-hmm. damage is violence. Exactly. Police brutality somehow isn't.
Yeah, it became this sort of perfect metaphor for alarmist writers to refer to it as Kristallnacht, and which is so offensive, I think.
Yeah.
But obviously very useful in Zionist framings of pro-Palestinian organizing as something that is inherently anti-Semitic.
When you get someone who has authorized the torture of 2,500 Palestinians, including five who died under torture, that is Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu. Now you tell me, who is creating the atmosphere of hostility?
I've been thinking about this protest a lot this last year because I kind of see it as like a warning sign. And I particularly remember how enraged Netanyahu was, and he spoke to the press here in Montreal outside of his hotel on Sherbrooke Street. He was at the Ritz-Carlton, and he was so enraged. And there was, from what I understand, the highest levels of Canadian government got involved in this, right? And there was a recommendation made that Netanyahu would not be able to be at Concordia, you know, and there's all these interstate relationships, right, between these security institutions of Canada and the security institutions of Israel, which I think points to a lot of problems and, you know, systemic issues that need to be addressed. But I would say that from what I understand, Netanyahu really wanted to still go to Concordia, but the RCMP, the Canadian police, had said that they couldn't guarantee safety at a certain protocol. So I remember like being in the Hall building, you know, I remember also when it was quite clear that they were going to try to block people from going from the mezzanine down to the first floor where H110 is. And I remember the riot police entering. And as the morning went on, this was pre-smartphones, but people were started calling also their friends to come and support. And the crowd was growing outside. And I distinctly remember back to migrant justice organizing. At the time, I was involved in sort of the networks that would become Solidarity Cross Borders, and we were supporting a whole network of Palestinian restaurant workers at the time who were facing deportation. And they weren't there at the beginning of the protest because they were working. But I remember later in the morning, them all showing up. They'd all just left work because they'd heard what was happening and they wanted to join the protest and support Palestine. These are Palestinians, but also to support the students. And this was a student-led action, and I'll just underline that.
This is the first of a two-part discussion on the 2002 Netanyahu riot. And our second episode, which will air on January 27th, will explore a little more in depth the issue of free speech and how that was weaponized, and the different layers to these issues of academic freedom and what constitutes the boundaries of that free speech. That will be explored by our interviewees and ourselves next time. And the rest of this episode, we're going to look a little bit more closely at the context of student activism in general at Concordia at this time, and in particular, the Concordia Student Union and how it was involved in the aftermath of September 9th.
So for those of you who listened to our last episode, you might be familiar with some of the context for what was happening on Concordia campus at this time. And I think that Concordia was really present in the news these days as what some referred to as this kind of radical playground for activists. It was seen as this kind of super far left, almost dangerous kind of campus in which a lot of students were mobilizing actively against corporatization, imperial power. There was a lot of action against the North American Free Trade Agreement, and you'll hear Sabine talk about that on one of our interviewees later. But just to sketch an image of Concordia as this university that was still kind of coming into its own, I guess, in terms of what its PR image was, whether there was international investment in it. And in the year previous, the CSU had published their student agenda or handbook that they called an agenda for uprising. And it was like very radically interested in taking arms for revolution, in, you know, burning the Canadian flag, was super like anti-colonial, very kind of provocative. And this had stirred up some media attention from commentators saying things like, is this a blueprint for Osama bin Laden's youth program in North America? The Gazette published an editorial denouncing the CSU as a personal playground for a bunch of radical professional activists. And this comes up a lot in media coverage of the September 9th protest as well, in that there's this kind of cementing of a judgment of Concordia students as just, you know, going to school in order to wet their feet as professional activists. It's like contrasted against the students who just want to go to class and who are apparently prevented from doing so because there's all this kind of uprising on campus.
Maybe this is a better thing for you to talk about, but Sydney, like, you just went to the Concordia archives and you were sending me pictures of articles from this time, including these spreads in the link, I think it was, about like asserting your protesting rights.
Yeah, exactly. It was really interesting actually to flip through the issues of the link that came out in the weeks and months after this event and seeing the tidal wave of different op-eds from, you know, frustrated or motivated or proud or pissed off students who were involved or not involved in the protest. And then also had things like, as you mentioned, tips and tricks for if you're attending your first protest, some things to bring along, some things to know about the systemic violence in the police force, what your rights are as a protester, what to say and not to say to police, how to guard against tear gas. These things are being published as a sort of answer to what happened and really represent what was on people's minds and what they thought was important to showcase and to learn about, given maybe this is the first time that some people had any kind of close-up encounter with a riot cop or witnessed firsthand that police don't actually maintain security, at least for most people, and things like that.
How aware were you of the kind of issue of Israel-Palestine before becoming a Concordia student or before your tenure as president?
So, you know, I went to university, it was in the late 90s I started. So that was like, if we think about time, you know, and how history goes, this is like 10 years after the wall, the Berlin Wall fell. So it was like the triumph of capitalism, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It was like there was no frontier that capitalism couldn't go into. It was like the time of free trade agreements as well. And so there were huge changes happening in our universities, but also like overall in our public services, you know, for example, in the healthcare system, it was the massive push towards privatization in municipalities, the same thing with the contracts. And of course, on our campuses, we felt that very strongly in the late 90s, you know, we felt how the university was, because it was a process of, like, you know, starving universities from funding. So universities, even though there was a tuition freeze, the freeze emanated from organizing from the student movements before us. So it's a continuation always. So universities were trying to be creative and trying to get funding, for example, including administration fees that were rising, mm-hmm. and also looking at privatization of programs, of course, but also like what we would call the commercialization of the university space itself. So there were all sorts of attempts at, you know, getting funding. For example, one thing that we mobilized against was the advertisements. There was this Zoom media advertisements in the bathrooms. They would just put ads in our bathroom, in our face. This didn't exist before, mm-hmm. you know, in the 90s and stuff. So now there was a huge push for that. The same thing with the food service agreements, where the Sodexo Marriott, which was like the monopoly on campus, also during the prison food system, but also campus systems, you know, at Concordia, they had the contract, they had this exclusivity deal, so no one else was allowed to serve food. We thought that was totally messed up, and we organized around that. So the student union became really a space where it wasn't just a governance space where you're like, you know, looking for your career and executive mm-hmm. and this and that. No, it was really, we took the position, it was a collective process too of we are a union, like a union defending the interests of students and principles of you know, open, accessible education, public education. So this was very much where I come from, including, you know, also all the struggles against the free trade agreements in 2001, spring of 2001. There was a big mobilization around the free trade agreement of the Americas in Quebec City, so big mobilizations, organizing for that. We were affiliated with the Canadian Federation of Students Quebec, and so we organized from there, like, 100 buses for students to go to the protest, and it was massive mobilization, including with all the other student associations across Quebec. And so this, you know, this is where, like I said, this is where I come from. I was active in the student union around that.
We see a lot and have heard in our conversations with people that history kind of builds on itself. You know, you come to the school, it has a bit of a reputation. You see this model for protest and strikes, and you can kind of build on that legacy.
Yeah, there's definitely some element of self-regeneration. We'll hear in the next part of this episode from Aaron Lakoff, who actually speaks about coming to Montreal to study because he wanted to become a more seasoned activist, or that he was just really impressed in what was going on here. And so I think that's something to think about as we talk about the events of this year, because they were sparked really symbolically as the first day of school, but then also were feeding into what was already this like context for how they were interpreted and how people understood their place as like representing a student body, for example, and on the union of CSU, and who the different figures and characters are who were like involved in this event.
At the time, in parallel, you know, early 2000s is also the time when there was the second Intifada in Palestine going on, you know. So, of course, Palestinian students or students who had connection to Palestine were very much organizing and very active. And incidentally, just on the free trade agreement, you know, Israel was the first free trade agreement Canada signed with. Mm. So connections were immediately drawn on this. And during the second Intifada, the Palestinian students were very, very active in organizing, you know, tables. We used to have tables in the mezzanine, like we as all of the student clubs and groups, and SPHR, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, was also a club of the CSU, and also Hillel. And so they organized a lot, but so when I was in the student union, you know, the administration or even like the Zionist right-wing students would come and complain to us that SPHR is distributing hateful material and so on. And so, you know, at the time I didn't know much about Palestine, so I would just like, we would sit down with the groups, we'd sit down with Hillel, we'd sit down, Hillel was the main Zionist organizing club on campus. And then the SPHR, and we'd like review the content, because we'd have to decide, like, is we had positions in the student union of, you know, we had anti-war positions, we had human rights positions. And so we would try to see, you know, what, for example, when SPHR would distribute materials, read the content and really, okay, you know, read it, check the sources and so on, to see if this was like what they were claiming it was, like hate material, you know. Mm-hmm. And what we came to conclusion is, like, based on like the sources and so on, including from Amnesty International and so on, that no, this was about human rights, what's mm-hmm. being organized on the table. And so we as a student union continued to defend the right of SPHR to table, for example, mm-hmm. or to hold a speaker. Norman Finkelstein, for example, there was a huge organizing against him coming on campus, and the university tried to shut it down. And so we always had to try to defend the space for Palestinian organizing mm-hmm. to happen.
That's interesting. So from what I understand, most of your maybe exposure to some of the kind of deeper issues at the heart of settler colonialism in occupied Palestine was from actually looking at what Zionist groups were like charging as offensive, or what SPHR was claiming was their right to do, and you were like sort of parsing through that almost.
trying to, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. She passed away now, but she went through that period in Germany. So this is one of the reasons why I became an activist too and care about human rights, you know, is that I couldn't understand how that could happen, something like this. And then, like, being in a university space where you're confronted with all these other realities too and other stories. Like, this is one nice thing about Concordia, is that there is a mix and we get to think together about different things, including also the genocide against indigenous people here in this country, the politicide against indigenous people here. So we started thinking about this a lot, and this continues to be part of my journey. And I continue to be active with the Palestinian Jewish Unity group as well, because once you see how, for example, also human rights can be manipulated, you can't unsee it anymore. And then you want to go to that issue of justice and social justice and so on.
When we were beginning to research this event, we both watched this film, Discordia, which is somewhat of a coincidence that shares the same name as this podcast. It was produced by two very recent graduates of Concordia, and you can see in the film that they still obviously have this kind of intimacy with a lot of the people in the film, and that allows them to have these close encounters with people. But I think their intention was to try to give, not necessarily an unbiased account, but a bit of an overview of some of the key players that were involved in the Netanyahu protest, and more importantly, the aftermath of what it sparked. Basically, my takeaway was that it was just showcasing the intensity of the polarization between different people who, you know, I don't want to say both sides because I don't really see it as two sides, but at least Zionism and the Hillel group and their actions. And then on the other side, people who are pro-Palestinian, including the SPHR and people in the CSU execs who are definitely very openly sympathetic most of the time towards pro-Palestinian organizing. And they gave an overview of, in the months following the event, what the administration implemented as a moratorium on speaking about the Middle East as an attempt to kind of create a cooling off period, and how that was breached by different people, how that made things worse potentially, and how it ended up just erupting into this boiling point of like extreme partisan politics in the school.
Yeah, the moratorium on discussion of the Middle East on campus was implemented by Rector Frederick Lowy and his cabinet. And this response that they described as a cooling off period really seemed to have the opposite effect. You know, it really embroiled tensions that were already on campus. And a lot of people started to get really fed up. Just given this kind of attitude, I think, on campus, and that was perpetuated by Rector Frederick Lowy as well, that this is a niche issue. This is a niche issue that only affects a little percentage of students on campus and yet has overtaken the whole campus.
This is from Frederick Lowy's letter from September 19th.
I was recording this in the archives at Concordia.
He outlines the actions taken by administration following the protest. We cannot allow the university's core mission to be subverted by political activities that impinge adversely on the majority of our students who do not wish to be involved. And we simply cannot tolerate intimidation or violence.
What happened in the aftermath of this event and this failed talk of Netanyahu and how students responded to the university repression, and how do you understand like the rest of that year?
I think the moratorium against talking about issues about the Middle East that Frederick Lowy, the rector at the time, we had a rector, not a president, but at the time, imposed was kind of a symptom of a general attitude the university had, where it was always like one-sided debate. So it was okay to even invite Netanyahu on campus, display the red carpet, like I said, on that side it was okay, versus on the other side, like previous years and so on, serious attempts by the university to always try to shut down organizing, but the other side, right? Mm-hmm. So what happened there is that the university was also very much blamed for in the public perception. It was like, what did you think? You know, you invited Netanyahu on campus. What did you think was going to happen? So the reaction of the authorities on campus were, okay, put the lid on top of this. But exactly like you said, the more you try to suppress organizing, the louder it gets too. So this was September, basically, end of September, the moratorium was implemented. But immediately the next day, we broke this moratorium. It became our mission to be like, no, we're going to made a banner drop, and we continued to organize with flyers and so on. It became even more of a student union issue than at that point, because the university was trying to suppress some of our members' rights to distribute information and present a different point of view. And so the year goes by and so on, and yes, there was by the university an attempt to intervene and interfere in the student union governance. So a few years before that, we accredited as a student union. So this is like a particular thing in Quebec where student unions can accredit like a labor union could and get guaranteed rights to be the representatives of its membership, the students, like the undergrads in this case.
To hear more about the Concordia Student Union Accreditation Drive, listen back to our second episode of Discordia on the radicalization of the CSU.
Accreditation law draws the line between, you know, student union organizing versus the administrations. They're not allowed to interfere in this under this accreditation law. But what they did is it was the complete opposite.
Why was it important for you personally, and then maybe more collectively CSU, to bail out and support in other ways those who were arrested on September 9th? And it seemed like there was a real kind of push on the part of the CSU to also not remain neutral, I guess.
Yeah, this idea of neutrality anyways, like no one is ever really neutral, right? Mm-hmm. Because being neutral, what we could say is being neutral is also like, it either reinforces the status quo or it seeks to change it. So we were like, no, the world is not perfect and we will be making mistakes. We did some mistakes and so on, but we will try and do the best we can to change things and to at least like rattle whatever we can and make noise to raise awareness about something, about issues. And so this was about student rights, human rights, and so on. The student union, we had a vision. We had a vision also in terms of like an injury to one is an injury to all, which is like the classic union cheesy term. But this was one thing I really held on to as well. For the arrests, for example, that happened on and around September 9th, there was no need for the CSU to bail people out per se. The charges were dropped, right? So the state tried to scare organizing and organizers, and they used their tactics of arrest and then put some kind of temporary charge, and then they drop it because they had nothing on people, you know, to be able to put criminal charges against someone. But the CSU tried to defend as best we could the students. So when there was a legal fund that was established to support with good lawyers, you know, so there was no need to bail out per se in this sense, but there was a legal organizing on that. And then of course also the advocacy center, which emerged from this period, because it wasn't just the police forces that were trying to intimidate, it was also the university administration, university security, who tried different charges against the Rights and Responsibilities Act at Concordia. And so, first of all, part of the accreditation, going back to that, is that students should be charged by peers. You know, it should be students judging students, not students be judged by administrators, who, of course, may not have the same interests. So implementing these structures and guaranteeing that judges, quote-unquote, would be appointed by the student union and not picked with some interest behind it by the administration. So those things, and the advocacy center, like I said, is something that was established in that period because university administration has institutional memory that student unions, for example, don't necessarily have. There's always a very strong turnover in a student environment, you know, versus in the university. Frederick Lowy is there many, many years. And including at the time when I was there, the chair of Senate was O'Brien, who was a president or rector at the time of Concordia in 69. So what we tried to do is at least having the student unions do what we could to keep memory and to keep the memory of organizing and of tactics the administration might use to crack down on organizing.
It's an interesting point because when I've gotten in touch with CSU execs for other episodes I've done, I've sort of asked about if they have their own archives, and it's always the same, you know, oh, there's the university archives.
But there was. We had an archivist in the student union at the time, and there was a little space and boxes organized by animal rights organizing and so on about the student union, but also interactions with the administration. The archivist at the time kept record of all the board of governors decisions and the mandates the student governors would get from their council to go and bring to the board of governors and so on. But after the new team came in, they got rid of the archive.
Oh.
So it just tells you how much this is a threat for the administration when students do try to implement long-term thinking. They got rid of those archives.
Though not without some prior violations, the controversial ban on discussing the Mideast was later lifted. In the film Discordia, we see them following a fiasco wherein Hillel was shut down as a Concordia student club for distributing IDF recruitment flyers after the ban was lifted. The CSU, accused of foregoing due process and shutting down Hillel, were then faced with a lawsuit and split opinions on their right to shutter the student club. This all seemed to actually keep the Israel-Palestine conflict at the center of student tensions, which helped to ultimately lead to the executives getting booted for a more apolitical government in the next election. This also fueled conversations around free speech on campus, which we'll get more into in part two of this episode.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
So I saw a lot come out in the link from people who were saying, you know, why are we dragging our baggage from our home countries into Canada? We're here to learn. We're here to have an education and later move into the world as professionals and not to become activists. And actually, John Galt published a piece on September 17th in The Link where he says, "We, the silently despairing student minority, are tired of the use of campus public space for hashing out distorted and geopolitically inaccurate psychodramas. The university's public space is only public, it seems, when events are in accordance with the radicals' dogmatic agenda." And he says, if you spent more time in class instead of out on the pavement, you might actually learn something. So again, we have this really condescending view of things that, you know, there's no place for this here. Why didn't you learn to get along with people and use school for what it's apparently meant to be used for? And we have a similar sentiment by a former Link copy editor who says that when she was hired, it didn't take her long to realize that her job was more of an internship for becoming a future UN peace negotiator in the Middle East than about copy editing and grammar restructuring. It seems like she felt like she was being indoctrinated into a certain kind of political space rather than just doing her work, quote unquote. And it's very telling that she ends the piece with saying, "Can we just go to class already?" And I think that this kind of exhaustion or this feeling that there's a small amount of students who are kind of working out their geopolitical dramas in an inappropriate space eventually leads to ousting the current CSU executives and ushering a period of fairly apolitical student government that is basically elected on a platform of, we will not like peddle these issues to the people who like don't care about them.
Yeah, I think their platform is essentially like, you know, school first, politics second. And, you know, across our episodes so far, particularly episode one about the 1969 computer center occupation, we see this again and again of people kind of being like, why are you bringing race and racism into this? Why are you bringing international geopolitical issues into this? We're just here to get an education. This isn't the place for it. And to me, that's just wild. I'm like, well, it's exactly the place for it.
I think it does refer back to something we've been talking about, though, and we'll continue to talk about, where it's like there are many different stakes for students on campus. And some people really do justifiably think of it as a privilege to go to school. But for them, that privilege is something that they are protecting by kind of sanitizing their education experience from what they see as these like disruptive elements that are preventing them from getting their education. Whereas someone else could argue that this is actually the education that you're getting. You know, you're getting an education in like the messiness of real world policies and how they are like affecting people who you're rubbing shoulders with. Whereas the liberal kind of move is to say like, well, can't we just keep those at bay? Isn't there a different space where those can be worked out? And obviously activists and people who are organizing this protest would say, no, this is not something that I can compartmentalize just in a classroom or just when I vote on the like election ballot or whatever it is. And even if you're a Canadian and this is something that appears to be happening thousands of miles away, as we have seen so intimately with the BDS movement, you know, we are not separate and we do not have the privilege of remaining disconnected from actual like literal economic and political investment in apartheid.
Yeah, it's something we hear over and over, that so-called neutrality is really just a pillar of the status quo. And in Canada and a lot of the world, yes, like access to higher education is a privilege. And that's part of the problem that a lot of these activists are pushing against, right? Like the fact that you do have to have maybe a certain economic background or take on astronomical amounts of debt to access education. And when you're coming to Canada as a refugee or an international student or a child of refugees, it's not happening in a vacuum. The fact that Canada is a very close ally of Israel, these are directly connected. And it's a serious point of privilege to say, like, leave that at home. And it is a racist perspective to tell people to leave it at home when they're here in Canada.
Well, not to mention that, I mean, a lot of the people who were involved, there are Palestinian students who are involved in organizing and attending the protest who were at Concordia on student visas and would have probably much preferred to have studied in their home country and were prevented from doing so. But there was a lot more at stake for them in attending something as risky as a riot that has so much militarized police presence, because their presence in Canada actually was always in jeopardy and they are at risk of deportation if seen to be in trouble with the law.
Yeah, and deportation to where is another question. Exactly. Because you see counter-protesters telling Palestinian activists, go home. And kind of the irony of that is that that's sort of the point.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, people like Samir Alatrash, who is followed in the Discordia documentary and who was a member of SPHR and I believe one of the organizers of the protest, refers to himself as in exile. And this is a pretty common narrative that a lot of people from Palestine, they are awaiting this UN and internationally recognized right of return that is being blocked by Israel and its colonialist genocidal actions in Palestine. But yeah, so I guess to come back to this aftermath and these unconcerned students, they then turned around and participated in what seems to have been an absolutely record voter turnout in the CSU election following the events of September 2002 and the moratorium and so on. People came out to vote in droves and elected Evolution, Not Revolution, this sort of centrist status quo, so-called apolitical party, like 2-1 or more than 2-1 to the next party.
In the following student election that happened, it's like we can say, yes, oh, it was a backlash, a right-wing backlash. This backlash we always faced anyways. I mean, the student union was always against the grain in that sense. Mm-hmm. But in that year, specific year after Netanyahu, the university really invested a lot of money in interfering in the student election. So, for example, they had a lottery going mm-hmm. for students to vote for like a trip to the south, like a trip to the Caribbean or something like that. Win this if you vote in the election. So they created these incentives. Mm. And of course, like we tried to fight it, but it was just like, it was a huge influx of like weight on this little student union, mm-hmm. which didn't have the full means to, not the way the university did. But I think the CSU continues to be a relevant space for organizing. I just think sometimes, and this was a tendency we also had, we think it's about it more in terms of governance, and or we think that, you know, what's the point of a council, a student council, and so on. But if we start thinking and seeing it as a union, and remember mm-hmm. reminding ourselves that we're there not for our own interests, but we are there to defend the interests of a collective mm-hmm. group, you know, the collective, then it changes maybe a bit.
Zooming out, now that you're not a student anymore, if you have anything to say about how things have shifted, if at all, over the past 23 years about, you know, student activism related to this.
You know, I was in a metro grocery store, mm-hmm. you know, buying my stuff, and then overhearing people saying, oh, I don't know if I can go, I have to go to the student strike, and, you know, it's all around. So for me, it was very encouraging, even in front of the genocide that's going on, you know, but just to see that people are continuing to organize. So I find it inspiring to see how creative students are around this, student organizers and community organizers. The conditions are a bit different on how we organize, let's say, but the desire to continue to struggle and organize still exists you know, so that's very encouraging for me. I can realize this after, you know, a few years being outside of university, is the powerful space a university is to organize from. And that's why student movements are so strong. When they do decide to move, like, they can move things in a society, you know, because it's a collection of so many different people and different roles and different ambitions, different worldviews that can come together sometimes and really organize and say no to something and push change.
What has changed the last 22 years with maybe particularly your involvement in Palestinian solidarity organizing or as a greater movement? How do you see the last two decades unfolding since this?
It's a great question, and there's many, many answers, thankfully. There's so many thousands of people involved in doing Palestine solidarity work today. And there's always been a lot of people in Montreal supporting freedom in Palestine. But I would say in the last two decades, there's been a larger political space opened up to support Palestine. I do remember at the time, there was a lot of hesitance to really speak about what was happening in Palestine as colonialism. And I think that there's been a whole shift, right? Like at the time, saying the term Israeli apartheid was extremely controversial. People in more mainstream spaces were simply talking about human rights abuses, right? But to try to frame it as a system was something that was still unfolding. And for us as activists who were also inherently critical of the Canadian state project as a colonial project deeply connected to the Israeli state, historically, we were also trying to sort of build that awareness and those connections and to understand that us being in solidarity with Palestine was about us also thinking critically about the Canadian state project as an inherently colonial infrastructure and sort of deconstructing and decoding and to think holistically in a positive way about all these interlocking systems of oppression around gender, around class, around race, and how they're all interconnected, right? And that's a lot of the discussions we are having. And I would say that a protest like this, there was a lot of learning that happened across different movements. And that's what really happens in a space like that. The late scholar Aziz Chaudhry wrote a lot about the learning that happens in social movements and how those discussions at times pointed are always an opportunity to recall and to sort of reconsider coded in frameworks of power and how power tries to force you to think about realities in specific ways and often in colonial ways, right? So Palestine is a window through which to reconsider a lot of structures of power and to think collectively about how those structures of power can be overcome. And those are intergenerational struggles. And so you talk about like 22 years, and I think that the movement for Palestine has developed in meaningful and amazing ways, but it also shows that these struggles are long and take time. But taking action in the present is also important. As we saw, Netanyahu was not welcome at Concordia University, and that's a victory for the student movement history at Concordia, but also for activism in Montreal more generally.
Thank you to Stefan Christoph and Sabine Friesinger for their interviews, Adi for voice acting, our volunteers, and to the CRFC Radio Meters program for funding Discordia.
2002 soundbites are from the NFB documentary Discordia by Ben Adelman and Samir Malal. Contact us at discordia@cjlo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode in the archives at cjlo.com, SoundCloud, and Spotify.
Tune in for the second part of this episode on Monday, January 27th at 6 p.m. on CJLO 1690 AM and CJLO.com.